Herbie, let's go.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
On the Lawrence Holmes Show.
I have my own issues and conflict with it, and why anyone else would too. I also understand someone that goes, well, in moments where there is a giant piece of grief, do we need to dig up the dirt on someone? And I just feel like there's, you can tell the whole story. How you tell the whole story is important too. I have my own standards on that. Other people have theirs, and I'm not here to tell them how to do their job. I can just tell you how I plan to do mine. And I think that it is important and does need to be discussed. And let me just give you the last paragraph of Nancy's piece, because I think that it really does speak to all of this stuff. And USA Today, you should read it. It's really, really good. Nancy writes, Bryant was neither a god nor a demon, though at times he resembled both. He was flawed and complicated, and it's okay to acknowledge that.
Make me a bicycle clown!
Welcome in. I'm Lawrence Holmes here with you until 2 o'clock. I am on Radio Row at Super Bowl 54. I've been taking a lot of pictures and videos of my experience down here. If you're on Instagram, because that's kind of basically what I'm doing is this. The content I'm giving you on my Twitter account. So podcasts that I'm doing down here, interviews, like stuff like that. That's going on the Twitter account. The fun stuff and some of the pictures, that's all going on Instagram. So if you're on Instagram, I'm at Lawrence W. Holmes on Instagram. And you could see some of the stuff that I've put up already in my stories. And I will keep doing that. There's actually a really cool set piece of the NFL 100 that has a bunch of the Bears on it, obviously. So I got pictures of that. You can see kind of what I'm seeing on Radio Row starting to fill up, that sort of thing is going on here. So we'll do a little bit of Super Bowl stuff, including Robbie Gould last night. He spoke with the Chicago media, and I'll share a little bit of that before we get out of here. We're also going to talk some White Sox today, and we're going to let you hear from Rick Hahn in case you missed it, because we felt it was an important thing to do coming off of what the White Sox and what White Sox fans have called a very successful and fun Sox Fest this past weekend. But we start the show, as we start all things, with a rundown.
Run them down!
The Rundown.
Here is your rundown for Tuesday, January 28, 2020. Let's start with the Bulls. Before the game, Jim Boylan was moved by the death of Kobe Bryant. He said this to speak on it.
Jim, you have two daughters that obviously are on the road at times and in the arena. And how much does what happened yesterday just
Well, you know. That's a tough question to answer.
It's a tough question to answer for a lot of people involved with the Bulls and a bunch of the players. They wanted to talk about Kobe as well. Thad Young said this.
Yeah, I was always amazed by his work ethic and what he does as a player. I mean, you know, I grew up as a kid, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, watching this guy. And, you know, I'm able to get out there on the court with him and you know, see what he brings to the game and what he brings to the, not just the game, but, you know, to people's everyday lives. I mean, he put Los Angeles on his back, you know, you know, as you can see, the whole city, you know, they stand behind him each and every day, and you know, and not just that city, but the whole world. You know, like I say, global icon.
It was cool to see the outpouring of affection from fans at the United Center last night, the house that Michael built, and a lot of people going to the concrete outside of the United Center with chalk and writing messages about Kobe. I thought that was a cool thing. Zach LaVine is one of those kids that was inspired by Kobe Bryant, and you can tell that Bryant, maybe even more than Jordan, was something that pushed him to getting to the NBA.
You miss so much from just what he brought the game of basketball.
he inspired a whole generation of kids, pretty much. Just, you know, they wanted to be like him. As, you know, like kids in the 80s and 90s wanted to be like Mike. You know, we wanted to be like Kobe. And, you know, growing up and seeing the different highlights, his hard work, I feel like that was one of the biggest things that he instilled in me, was his hard work. And I try to bring that to my game, and his passion for the game, how ruthless he was and as a competitor. But it was more than that, you know, as a basketball player. But, you know, he was a father. You know, there was more families on there, and it's just terrible what happened, man. And, you know, it's just such a loss in so many different ways.
On to the game. Inside the game, the Bulls paid tribute to Kobe, taking an 8-second penalty.
Mark Davis, the veteran official, gives it up to Thomas Satoransky. He's just going to dribble it out in backcourt, and there's going to be an 8-second count against the Bulls, and this crowd on their feet to honor Kobe Bryant, jersey number 8. And that's going to be a turnover on the Bulls, and so it'll be a San Antonio Bull. And this crowd with chants of Kobe. A lot of 24 and 8 jerseys, Laker jerseys. Kobe Bryant with 20 seasons of Laker basketball.
A lot of the NBA teams took 24-second violations and 8-second backcourt violations to honor Kobe. Then the two teams played, and guess what? The Bulls won.
Double on the ball on the left wing in front to Satoransky. Right quarter, Dunn to the rim. Dunn gives it up. Left quarter, Young for 3. Yes! Big time onions, Thaddeus Young for 3, deep in the near quarter.
The Bulls last night did a really good job of hitting threes late in the game. And overall, they were 38% from behind the arc. They win 110-109 is the final over San Antonio. Now, on to baseball. Nicholas Castellanos is going to join the Reds. He signed a 4-year, $64 million deal to go to Cincinnati. It's got an opt-out after a year. He wants to make sure everything is right. And we loved interacting with Castellanos as a Cub. And this was a moment where a lot of people who were fans of the Cubs and Castellanos maybe fell more in love with him.
I don't know. It just does. It's easy for something that we love to get looked at like a business, you know? And I feel like that sucks. And that, not just in baseball, but just like in everything in life, you know? So that shit, it just makes me feel good to hear him say that.
That was when Joe Maddon had told us how much he appreciated Castellanos' approach to the game. And then we had Castellanos on the next day. He broke down in front of the crowd, and it was a really, really great moment. I really like that guy. I was hoping he'd end up on the White Sox. I felt like he's the perfect type of veteran to add to their clubhouse. Plus, he's really good offensively. Good luck to him in Cincinnati. The Reds are trying to put together a team that can compete for that division, and they just took away one of the Cubs' big offensive pieces for the second half of the season. That is your rundown for Tuesday, January 28th, 2020. We need to take a timeout, and the reason why is that with the news of over the weekend about Kobe Bryant, we basically made our show about Kobe yesterday, as I thought that we should, and we're going to spend some more time covering the Kobe story with J.A. Adande at 12:40. I want to make sure that White Sox fans get served, because it was a crazy weekend for them. It's a good weekend for the White Sox as an organization. Their general manager was on the show, and it's a good interview. So we're going to share it again for those who missed it. It's coming up next here on The Score. The bottom of the hour is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Do your youth hockey team want to play in front of thousands? Make it happen with the Chicago Wolves youth hockey program presented by Kia. Visit chicagowolves.com/youth hockey to learn more. I'm Lawrence Holmes. I'm at Super Bowl 54. I'm on Radio Row, and I have a bunch of pictures and videos that are on my Instagram. So if you're on the gram, at Lawrence W. Holmes is where you can find my feed, and I got good stuff inside my story. We wanted to make sure that we served White Sox fans, because this is an exciting season. That it looks like it's going to be an exciting season. It's already been an exciting offseason. So as you were getting ready to head to Sox Fest on Friday, I talked with the general manager, Rick Hahn, and I asked him about this offseason that the White Sox have had.
It's represented a nice step forward to get us closer to our ultimate goals. Look, when we started this thing 3 years ago, when we started this rebuild back with the Chris Sale trade, it was about putting us in a position to contend annually for championships. And over the first 3 years, you know, some good things have happened. We've been able to see at the big league level guys like Moncada and T.A. and Giolito last year take those steps forward. This year, you know, we're looking for Eloy to join that group. You know, we have Luis Robert coming up at some point. But we always knew it was going to be about augmenting this core as it evolved with some talent from outside. That was going to be a necessary step as well. So it was a big step forward last year. As you saw, a lot of those young players take a step forward. We're going to continue this year to add more young players like Luis Robert and, in all probability, at some point, Nick Madrigal and perhaps others. You know, have Michael Kopech return, Carlos Rodon return, and that young core is going to continue to grow. But this offseason, we were able to do a decent job of adding some quality veteran talent to round it out and complement it to get us closer to that goal.
Before we talk about the shiny new toys, I want to talk about some of your ascending players that were already on the roster. To me, Moncada, and I know that there was a little bit of a kerfuffle when James gave him an MVP vote, and when I went back and looked at the MVP voting, there were guys that I thought that Moncada was better at that finished higher than him. And when you look at whether it's B-War or F-War, we're talking about a somewhere between a 5 and 6 win player that he turned into. What happened with Moncada, one, at third base, and two, in him cutting down his strikeouts looking that made him be a more complete player?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with what we were talking about probably at Sox Fest a year ago, or at least last offseason, at least when it comes to his approach at the plate. He, right after season ended last year, went out to Arizona and went through every at-bat that he struck out on, and worked with Ricky and worked with our hitting coaches to break down exactly the ways that he could improve his approach at the plate. And as we made no secret about publicly, we were obviously no one was satisfied with what he did in 18, but that's such a better foundation to build off of, a guy who knows the strike zone and just needs to be more aggressive earlier in the count on hittable strikes, as opposed to teaching a guy who's all over toes to nose and in and out of the strike zone, swinging at everything. That's real tough to rein in. Moncada had the starter kit that coaches love to teach, but build off that discipline to teach you to hunt more strikes earlier and do damage on them, what you're capable of doing. So I think that mindset helped kick in, and I think that he also realized how pitchers were trying to get him out and how he was helping them by going too deep sometimes and falling behind in counts by letting hittable pitches go. As for third base, you know, Johan made no secret. He told us he had gold gloves as playing third base back in Cuba. Now, no one's produced these gold gloves, but he had told us that he was real comfortable over there, and he was going to show us that was a natural position for him. And I think he did. I think it allows his athleticism to take over on more bang bang type plays. And you can see the type of player that he is.
You've had a couple players in the White Sox organization, great players, and Paul Konerko and Frank Thomas, who went through this too. Frank more so than Paulie, but the idea of, I know that's not a strike, even though it might get called a strike. How hard is it for a guy that does have a sense of what the actual strike zone is for them to let go of kind of what they know because they're getting rung up on looking strikeouts?
Yeah, and that's obviously, that can only happen when you have two strikes on you. And we at no point wanted to instill in anyone, Moncada included, that, hey, with two strikes, you know, you need to swing at balls out of the zone. That, you know, the umpire might make a mistake, so you better expand. We want him to protect better, obviously, with two strikes, but at no point was it about making him, you know, chase or anything, so to speak, when there were two strikes, so to cut down on those undue looking, you know, called looking. It was more about earlier in the count, you know, 0-0 or when there's one strike on you. If you're getting the ball that you can do some damage on, let it eat. You don't have to wait for the exact perfect spot. You don't have to work for the walk. You don't have to wait till you're 3-1 to really get after it. And that's where I think you saw more of it. You saw fewer called looking on two strikes simply because he didn't quite get there. He was doing his damage earlier.
White Sox GM Rick Hahn joining me here on The Score. How do you explain the jump that Tim Anderson made last year?
Repetition. I just think it's a matter of him getting more and more comfortable and what his approach is and what his skill set is capable of producing at the big league level and how pitchers are trying to get him out. You know, he was a kid from draft day through each year of his minor league ascent to Chicago and continues down in Chicago that we talked about of having amazing raw tools, but still being a bit of a student when it comes to learning the game of baseball, and that with repetition each year, we expected we were going to see better and better. You know, there's still some refinements to be made for him, but you know, you look at him today versus who he was 3 years ago, and he's, you know, really starting to fulfill the potential that his tools presented. And I think that's because of his hard work and repetition.
Does he have to walk, Rick, or can he hit his way to a 350 OBP for the rest of his career?
I mean, that's a dangerous life to live, hoping that you're going to hit your OBP. But we have seen some players do it, and the players who are capable of doing it have similar skill sets to TA, and that is he can touch balls out of the zone with authority and drive them and use the whole field in doing that. It's not what you teach. You're not going to take a young kid and teach him that kind of approach because you're going to want to hopefully have that discipline to fall back on and take those walks. But TA's a smart hitter too. He knows in certain situations that they might try to prey off of his aggressiveness, and that's actually the situations where you see him take that walk and lay back a little bit. But he's also the kind of dangerous hitter that if a pitcher makes a mistake that tries to get him to chase off the plate and misses by a little bit and gets a little bit too close to the zone, that TA is going to do some damage on it.
What did you take away from the jump that Giolito had from being statistically the worst starting pitcher in Major League Baseball to then being at the All-Star game last year? What does an organization learn about a player when they see a player do that?
Well, I think there's sort of macro lessons and micro lessons. And by that, I mean from a macro standpoint. I mean, think back to a year ago, right now, and I'm guessing there were probably a few tweets from White Sox Nation, you know, calling Giolito or calling Moncada a bust. Now, hopefully those people have scrubbed their accounts so they don't look foolish in retrospect. But I think there is a lesson there. You know, unfortunately, and as much as it would make all of our lives easier and more enjoyable, unfortunately, there is some development that has to take place at the big league level. And not every guy gets here hitting the ground running and is immediately able to make an impact. We're hopeful that guys are fully prepared and ready to come close to their ceilings early in their careers. But those guys tend to be the exception, and you got to leave room for some big league development and try to withhold judgment the best you can. We saw that with Moncada, and we saw it with Giolito from 18 to 19. And, you know, it's something to keep in mind here over the next couple of years as we continue to add young, talented guys to Chicago. On the micro level, I mean, look, it's a testament to how bright of a athlete Lucas is. You know, he went home obviously dissatisfied with his performance in 18. And also open-minded about making adjustments to his delivery to enhance or to correct, I should say, some of the weaknesses that he had when he was a little longer in the arm action. The ability for his arm to catch up to the rest of his body, especially on breaking pitches, was a little bit more difficult for him when he had his previous delivery. So it takes a smart and self-aware guy to be able to know that a change is needed and to go about as shrewdly as he did to get right after the issue.
He talked a lot about how McCann helped him, and I was in the clubhouse talking to McCann a lot. I think he's so smart, and I enjoy talking to him about being a receiver in the game. So you have this catcher who gels with your number one. He has an all-star season too, and then you're like, well, wait, we might be able to bolster the catcher position. What were those conversations like with James and inside the organization when you realized that you had an opportunity at Grandal?
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, look, James is fantastic in terms of the fit in the clubhouse and obviously had a really good year last year. And we continue to view him as an important piece on a good club because of what he brings both offensively and in the clubhouse. And to his own credit, you know, there's knocks on James out there in the world, the sabermetric world, in terms of his framing and the metrics that he put up last year. And to his credit, he took ownership of that. And in fact, he and I had a conversation yesterday about the work he's done to correct some of that or address some of that. So I think he has a chance to be even better this year than he did last year. Additionally, though, or to look at the Grandal exhibition, you know, we had a chance to add one of the elite performers at a premium position, a guy who not only works extremely well with the pitchers he's been with at each of his stops, but is a real complement to what we have offensively, both in terms of his left-handed power as well as his ability to get on base. So when you have the chance to add a one of the best in the game at a premium position to fit and continue to move this process forward, it was an opportunity we didn't want to pass up.
Is it too easy to say that you guys signing Grandal when you did and for what you did opened up the door to the rest of your free agency plan?
I think it's a little too easy to say that, but I can't completely rule it out. And by that, I mean, obviously, Yasmani, you can't control when these guys sign. I would love to have all this done, you know, in between the GM meetings and the winter meetings, which was the window that we were able to get Yaz done on. That's unique. I mean, Yaz is an extremely thorough and thoughtful player. So, you know, when we met with him, he had he ate up the presentation. He had follow-up questions. He had follow-up requests for video. And he knew what he felt his value was. So once we were able to get his understanding that he wanted to be with us, we were able to move quickly, which was ideal. Would love to do that. But obviously at the time when he committed, there wasn't, you know, he was the first one. There weren't, we told him what the rest of the plan was going to look like, but he still had to take that leap of faith. And others that came after him, I think they had their own calculus going on. Some of them were joining us because they wanted to be in Chicago. They wanted the chance to win. They knew what we were about. They knew what playing for Ricky was like, and they wanted to be part of it. But I do think for, you know, perhaps I think even Dallas mentioned this during his early press conference, the introductory press conference, about how once he saw Yaz was with us, he got a little more excited. So it definitely had an effect, but I don't think it was as simple as the world took notice once we got Yaz.
Yaz and Maz. That is what we now know, that Yasmani Grandal's nickname is Yaz, and the White Sox have themselves a Yaz, and they got a Maz out in right field. So that was Rick Hahn. We had a great, great conversation. There's actually about 10 minutes more of that conversation, and you can go back and check it out on Friday's podcast of the show if you want to take a listen to some of the other things that we got into. We need to take a break. When we come back, Jay Adonde is going to join me. He's covered Kobe Bryant for a really long time. I'm looking forward to get his thoughts on Kobe's legacy, the way the story has been covered, and what happens next here on The Score. Lawrence Holmes back here with you. I'm at Radio Row at the Super Bowl, at Super Bowl 54. We've been covering the Kobe Bryant story down here, too, and it's been interesting to see some of the impact from that Kobe had on NFL players. Like last night at NFL media opening night, there were a lot of players that were talking about what Kobe meant to them, and you have players from both the Chiefs and from the 49ers that are dedicating this game to Kobe. Jay Adonde covered Kobe for a really long time on a bunch of different platforms. He is also the director of sports journalism at the Medill School at Northwestern University and a friend of the show. And it's nice to have him here on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from. J.A., thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks, Lawrence.
So in trying to put all of this together and figuring out legacy and history, I was wondering if we could maybe go back a little bit. When you first started covering Kobe, and I know that you linked a couple of pieces on your Twitter account about it too, what type of person was he, and then what did he end up becoming?
Yeah, he went from an excitable teenager with big dreams to a wise person with great perspective and very calm, and that slowing down that comes with age. You're not as rushed. You've done it all. You're in no hurry, and you can look back over what you've done. And then in between, he could be stubborn and you know, manipulative, all types of terms. It's really the totality, and I think that's what we're attempting to do. Is you look back at Kobe, the totality of it, and 41 years old is such a young age to lose your life, but he packed so much into those four decades, and including the two decades that he spent in the NBA, that there's still a lot to unravel and discuss, even though it was such a short life.
We were trying to figure out yesterday how people in Chicago were going to react. And what I've thought about over the last few days is that as we try to protect the Jordan legacy, like we're big into being the doorman in front of the club of the Jordan legacy, that I feel like a lot of Bulls fans before what happened this weekend had kind of ushered Kobe through the door. And I wonder if that's because of how much of Jordan they saw in Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, and I think they would do both themselves and Kobe a disservice to do that. And it also doesn't take into account Michael's approval of Kobe in a lot of ways. I remember going to do a story on, well, Kobe was in a stretch of like seven straight games of 40-plus points or something, or he had like a 50-point streak going. I remember he just caught on this stretch where it was just bringing Jordan-esque comparisons, and certainly, you know, the numbers were reminiscent of Jordan. And Michael was playing with the Wizards at that time, and I was in D.C., and I asked him about just what he thought about Kobe and where Kobe was at. And he said what he saw in Kobe that reminded him of himself was that desire to separate himself from his peers. So for Michael, it was he wanted to be better than Magic and to, you know, eradicate any thought that the Blazers didn't need to draft him because they had Sam Bowie, you know, which resulted in the shrug game during the finals. So he just wanted to eradicate and create separation between him and all the peers of his era. And he said he saw that in Kobe. And what Kobe, the one time I heard him directly compare himself to Michael was when he said that he and Michael did things the same way and that they just wanted to shoot first. And they were willing to take on five players at once if need be. And a lot of people don't like that, and they don't want to hear that. And that's not their idea of what basketball should be. But that's the way Kobe did it, and that's the way Michael did it. And, of course, Kobe patterned it after Michael. So the fact that Kobe embraced Michael, you know, and took on the daunting task of trying to, you know, trying to surpass Michael, that's what everyone who plays basketball should do, right? You know, Michael used to say, don't try to be me, try to be better than me. And Kobe took him to task, or took him to heart when he heard that saying. And the fact that Michael approved and saw a lot of himself in the willpower and the determination of Kobe, that should let Bulls fans know and Michael Jordan fans know that, you know, it's okay. You can have both. You know, one doesn't negate the other. You can accept a world in which we saw both of them play, in which we saw them play in a similar manner. Now, that video has been resurfacing and making the rounds again. I'm sure you've seen it on Twitter of that edit, that mashup of Kobe's moves and Michael's moves and how they're virtually one and the same. Have you seen that one?
I have.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it just lets you know, okay, like it's the closest thing that we've seen and the closest thing that we ever will see to Michael.
J.A. Adande joining me here on The Score to talk about Kobe Bryant. How big of a part of Los Angeles and Los Angeles culture was he?
He was huge, and he crossed over so many areas. You know, Hollywood loved him. You know, the vendors on the street loved him. There's a great story in the L.A. Times about how much Kobe meant to Latino population, which is obviously a huge community in Los Angeles area. And Kobe, more than any other non-Latino athlete, really resonated. You know, the fact that he married a Mexican-American woman and the fact that he could speak Spanish in his interviews. You know, like, there wasn't any aspect that Kobe didn't say. You know, he was hugely popular in China and among Asian Americans. White, black, you name it. Like, there was no corner of Los Angeles that Kobe didn't reach out to. And Los Angeles is a very disparate place. It's very spread out. It's a collection of different cities, geographically immense, and it's very hard to bring the entirety of that together. And one thing that really did was Kobe Bryant.
I want to pick your brain on a couple of journalism issues with this story, because you care about journalism and doing it the right way, and you teach that at Medill. How do we do justice to telling the entire story of Kobe's life while also, in some cases, being fans of what he did on the floor. When it comes to the sexual assault and false imprisonment allegations, how do we tell both of those stories simultaneously?
I literally just got out of class in which we were talking about that with my sports media history class for about 80 minutes. The easiest way to do it, I would say, is to avoid talking about it on Twitter, because Twitter doesn't allow for lengthy discussion or nuance. And we saw a reporter for the Washington Post get suspended by the Post because her response to the death of Kobe Bryant was to retweet a story that kind of revisited that whole sexual assault case. And while that response by the Post is probably extreme, it also shows that it wasn't a well-thought-out tweet. You know, if your response to a horrific helicopter crash that kills 9 people, including the daughter of, you know, this prominent person, is to tweet out a story about a, at this point, 17-year-old sexual assault case, and the story itself was 3 years old, you know, that's not very nuanced or subtle. You know, we are talking about the totality. And so Kobe is not simply the sexual assault case. He's not simply a 5-time NBA champion. He's not simply a parent, right? He's all of those things. And so you need to allow the space to try to address all of those in a meaningful way, and Twitter doesn't allow you to do that. And I would also say that, you know, some people who felt the need to jump in right away on Sunday and said, let's not forget he was also accused. Well, let's see what the coverage looks like first. You know, don't admonish people for not including something in the coverage if they haven't even written their story yet. You know, and I'm sure as we – there's going to be a lot of time to talk about this. We've already spent 2.5 days doing it, and it will continue. And as we do so, inevitably we will talk about the sexual assault case. And, you know, it's a little frustrating because we'll never have a definitive answer, right? There were only 2 people in that room who knew what happened, and one of them is now passed away. So now it's impossible to ever get a balanced account of what happened now, or for someone to present his defense. If the accuser were to resurface and tell her story, you know, now we don't have anyone who could present a countering opinion. So let's look at the totality. Let's find the appropriate forums, right? So in the course of, if you and I are talking for 10 minutes or so, you know, we have time to talk about everything. But if it's just a 90-second hit, well, no, we can't get anything. We can't do it just. And you don't want to just make a casual, fleeting, passing reference to it either. You don't want to just say the Colorado thing, right? You need to take time to discuss it. But you also need to discuss it within the context of the entirety of his life. And I don't think that moment, particularly because there was not a conviction. It'd be one thing if he was a convicted rapist. He was accused of sexual assault. The charges were dropped. So because there wasn't that declaration by the courts, you know, that definitive answer that he did something wrong, you know, I don't think we should overshadow the entirety of his life by that one moment, by that 1 year period.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, Professor, is how the actual news of his death got out. And the coverage of it, I feel like we're in such a dangerous time right now when it comes to trying to get things first. And I'm a big proponent of getting it first is great. Getting it right is better. And if you can get it first and right, that's the best thing as far as journalism goes. How is the genie out of the bottle now with so many different outlets and so many different standards on what is and what isn't the way to cover something? Is there ever going to be a time when false reporting on stuff that is so tragic is not going to be a part of our discussion?
Well, particularly on social media, you know, and that's another thing. And that's why, and I keep coming back to this, but people shouldn't confuse or conflate social media with the media. But we do so quickly. People shouldn't really think of social media as an alternative. You know, it should be like a part of this well-balanced diet, as they used to say in the cereal commercials. You know, if you rely on it strictly, you're not going to get the full story. And it can be dangerous. There can be a lot of misinformation out there as well. But the bottom line to me, there's really not much of a journalistic lesson here, because the main thing is TMZ had it first and they had it right. Then you get into the ethics of should they have reported it before the families were notified. It's just, I posed that question to everyone in my to my class, and everyone agreed that journalistically TMZ did the right thing. They had no problems with TMZ reporting it as it was, because TMZ had it right. You know, we talk, and yes, the most important thing is to get it right, more so than getting it first. Well, TMZ had both.
Well, my issue wasn't necessarily their reporting. It was some of the ancillary reporting that happened after that, where we're now guessing about who was on the helicopter. And that, to me, just seemed like it was below standard.
A lot of it was. But you have to be restrained. And that includes just people on social media. I was very conscious of, while I wanted to try to be inclusive of the other lives that were lost on the helicopter, and you know, we need to keep in mind 8 other people died aboard that helicopter. You know, I also was very careful about tweeting out stories that weren't verified. So, example, I saw one thing that said, you know, this entire family was killed on the helicopter crash. Well, it turned out that 3 of the 4 people in the picture, or maybe it might have been 4 out of the 5 people in the picture, were killed, but not the entire family, right? And so if I had tweeted that out, even though my intentions were good to try to honor some lives lost, I would have, you know, effectively said somebody had died that hadn't died. So, you know, you can be responsible and not continue and not put out misinformation, right? So you need to exercise restraint. You need to, before you go retweeting anything or treating anything as fact, find a second source. You know, so really, just because TMZ was reporting it, you know, I'd be a little hesitant, despite their track record of being right. You know, I need to see a little bit more than a tweet from TMZ before I go talking about something like this, right? And just for every aspect of it, you know, I think there were some people who were saying Rick Fox was aboard. No, Rick Fox is alive and well, you know. So just be careful. Be careful in how you consume, you know. So even if you're not in the media, the way you consume media and the way you spread media and share media, which is, you know, something that we all can do now, is share media. Be careful in how you share media.
I think that's incredible advice. J.A., I appreciate the time and the well-rounded discussion on Kobe Bryant. Thanks for being on the show.
All right. You got it. Take care, Lawrence.
That's J.A. Adonde, longtime journalist, professor and director of sports journalism at the Medill School at Northwestern. I really think that guy is one of the smart guys in our business, and I learn something from him every time we have a conversation. We need to take a break. When we come back, why did Nicholas Castellanos choose the Reds? What's going on with the Cubs? What's going on with Marquis? I'm going to talk with Patrick Mooney of The Athletic about that next here on The Score.